KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. How can you predict if a child will succeed? Paul Tough argues that character, and not IQ, is the most important predictor of early success. Tough's new book is called How Children Succeed: Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Tough spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 20th, 2012.
I want to talk for a while about my book and then invite questions and comments from you. And How Children Succeed is a book of stories about people, but at its heart, it is really a book about an idea. And the idea at the center of the book is that the conventional wisdom that has governed our thinking about child development and education for the past couple of decades has been misguided. That we've been emphasizing the wrong skills with kids, and we've been pursuing the wrong strategies to help kids develop those skills. The name that I give to this conventional wisdom is the cognitive hypothesis. And what I mean by this is the idea that I think a lot of us share, even if we don't often speak it out loud, that the one thing that matters in a child's success is his or her IQ. That what matters most is that narrow range of cognitive skills that get measured on standardized tests. I think that this idea is behind our national obsession with test scores, whether you're talking about preschool admissions tests or statewide standardized tests or SAT and ACT scores. I think we're all, even when we tell ourselves that they don't matter, I think as a nation we've invested them with a ton of importance. And the reason I think we do that is that on some level we believe that what they measure is what matters. But the scientists and educators who I write about in this book have identified a very different set of skills. Things like self-regulation, grit, curiosity, optimism, perseverance. Economists call these skills non-cognitive skills. Neuroscientists often call them executive functions. Psychologists call them personality traits. And educators, and I think a lot of us, call them character. So when I was writing this book, I followed two different tracks at once. First of all, I spent a lot of time with people who were working directly with kids, trying to help them succeed. A lot of educators, some pediatricians, mentors. And then I spent a lot of time reading all of the research around this question of how kids succeed to try to find out what we really knew about how that happens. And something happened while I was starting my reporting that changed my perspective on the whole thing, which is that my wife and I had our first child. My son Ellington just had his third birthday. And so I had this weird experience in the first year of his life where I would spend the day reading these incredibly dense, complicated neuroscience papers about the importance of the first years of life in a child's development. And then I'd go hang out with Ellington and play with stuffed animals and trains and make goo-goo sounds. And I would try not to get too self-conscious about what I was doing. But it was hard not to use him as kind of an experimental subject. And one of the things that I try to do in the book is to show the connections between these different fields that I don't think often get connected, the way that neuroscience can tell us something about education. Specifically, the discovery that I think neuroscientists have made that is really profound is the connection between infant brain chemistry and adult psychology. That lying deep beneath these noble, complex qualities that we call character are really the mundane and mechanical interactions between chemicals in the brains of developing infants. So when Ellington was growing up especially, or when in his first couple of years of life, I thought a lot about the biology of stress. And this was not a field that I knew much about before I started working on this book. And I really learned about it through this doctor, this pediatrician in San Francisco, named Nadine Burke Harris. And she was useful to me in lots of ways. She was great at explaining how all of the science worked. But her story itself, I found, I found really compelling. So she grew up in Palo Alto in a relatively comfortable family, but she was very committed to trying to help kids in poverty. She went to medical school. She went to the Harvard School of Public Health. She ended up opening her own clinic in Bayview Hunters Point, this low-income neighborhood in San Francisco. And she was like a lot of Harvard graduates when she got there, which is that she thought she knew everything. She thought she knew exactly how to help these kids. And there is sort of like a public health checklist if you're starting a clinic like hers. And she ticked off everything on that checklist. She gave these kids the immunizations they were missing. She told them about nutrition. She gave them medicine for the various ailments they had. But she still felt like their real problems were something that she couldn't immunize them against, that they were living in so much chaos and turmoil and violence that it was having a profound effect on how they were doing. And so she started reading the literature around stress and early life. And what she found is this study called the ACEs study that talks about how significant early trauma is, specifically in terms of later health. So kids who experience a lot of trauma in childhood are 2 times more likely as adults to develop cancer, 2 times more likely to develop heart disease, 12 times more likely to commit suicide. And those same reactions that happen in the brain that create those health problems also create mental health problems. They make it harder to be happy, easier to be anxious or depressed. And they also create problems with this set of skills known as executive functions, the ability to process information, to deal with conflicting information, exactly the sort of things that matter on the first day of school. So this early stress is bad in all sorts of ways, and it's difficult to compensate for, but she really changed her whole practice around to try to focus on these skills, to try to help the kids she was serving with the problems that were most central in their lives. The research around stress can be a little bit distressing and overwhelming, but one of the things that's hopeful about it is that there is something of an antidote to stress. There's a secret weapon if you're trying to protect kids in disadvantage from stress, and that secret weapon is parents. That when kids are able to form a close, nurturing, attuned bond with a parent or other caregiver, what psychologists call secure attachment, they are protected from a lot of the effects, the negative effects of stress. If you take 2 kids, and they're both growing up in a really adverse environment, but one kid has a close relationship with a parent or another caregiver, all of those negative effects on the brain and the body and the executive functions that you see in the child without that kind of connection tend to disappear. So I spent a lot of time while I was rolling around on the rug with Ellington thinking about the way that parenting can sometimes give protection. And specifically, there was one study that I thought about a lot, and it was a study that was done in Montreal, in McGill University, a few years ago with rats. One of my great fears is that Ellington is going to grow up and read this book and realize that while I was playing with him as an infant, I was mostly thinking about rats. But it's true, and it's mostly because of this one study. So this neuroscientist named Michael Meany, about 12 years ago, had a whole colony of lab rats, like most neuroscientists do. And they were all divided up into individual plexiglass cages where a mother and a few babies known as pups would be. And these neuroscientists noticed that there was this one particular behavior that some of the mothers did. And they did it when their pups were stressed out. And if you're a rat pup in a lab, the thing that stresses you out the most is when a graduate student comes in and picks you up and weighs you or measures you or cleans your cage or something and then puts you back into the cage. So these little rat pups would be completely freaked out and shaking. And some of the mother rats would do this one particular thing called licking and grooming. And it wasn't about improving the pup's appearance. It was about soothing them. It was about calming them down, giving them the tools to calm themselves down. So these neuroscientists decided they wanted to figure out exactly what was going on with licking and grooming. What was the effect of this one little behavior? So they did an experiment where they divided the mother rats into 2 categories, the ones who licked and groomed a lot, and they called them the high LG rats, And the ones who didn't lick and groom much at all, they called them the low LG rats. And they split them up. Each mother rat raised her pups for the first couple of weeks of life, licking and grooming or not licking and grooming. Then they separated the rat pups from their mothers after 2 weeks, let them grow up to adulthood. And then when they got to adulthood, which is about 3 months for a rat, they gave them this whole battery of tests. And the high LG rats did better on all kinds of tests. They were better at mazes. They ate more. They were braver. They were more curious. They were bolder. They lived longer. They were healthier. You could actually see the effect of the licking and grooming in brain scans on certain parts of their brains, all because of this one idiosyncratic behavior that their mothers did months before in infancy. So I spent a lot of time when I was hanging out with Ellington thinking about what it might mean to be a high LG human parent. I want to assure you, I did not lick my son. And if you look at photographs of him from that first year of life, you'll know that his mother and I didn't groom him much at all either. But I do think that there is a human equivalent to high LG parenting, and I think it involves a lot of soothing and comforting and loving and hugging and all the things that I think come really naturally to a lot of parents. One of the things that I like about doing this reporting is that I was in a lot of different places, a lot of different cities, different types of contexts, but I would often find parallels and connections between two different parts of the reporting I was doing. And so a lot of the time while I was hanging out in rat labs, I was also writing about these two schools in New York City that were trying a new experimental method of character education. These two schools were very different. One was the Kip Infinity Charter School, which is a middle school in West Harlem serving a mostly low-income population. The other is the Riverdale Country School, which is one of the most elite private schools in New York City, where tuition just topped $40,000 a year. So these are two very different schools, very different populations. But a few years ago, the educators who were leading these schools found themselves in a similar situation. That they were doing a great job on paper. The students at KIPP were getting fantastic test scores. The students at Riverdale were getting into all kinds of Ivy League schools. But they both felt that their graduates were missing something, that they were missing the inner strength, the persistence, the perseverance, the grit, the self-discipline to deal with setbacks and challenges. And that then they would get out into life, whether it was in college or beyond, and they would encounter a real setback, the way all of us do, and they would get totally derailed. So they decided that they wanted to figure out a way to teach character to these kids. And so they started working with a team of psychologists from the University of Pennsylvania to figure out what character strengths were most important for students to have. And they came up with a list of seven, and two of them on the list were curiosity and self-control, which are two of the skills that those high LG pups had developed as well. So I've got the full list of seven character strengths here that you need if you're a KIPP or a Riverdale student. They are optimism, zest, curiosity, social intelligence, gratitude, self-control, and grit. And it's grit, I think, that gets people's attention the most. I think partly because it has, as a word, a lot of resonance for us with some deep American qualities. There's the whole John Wayne thing that you can't help think about when you're talking about grit. But as a psychological category, it's actually a pretty new invention. It's the invention of this woman, Angela Duckworth, a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania. What's interesting to me about Angela is that she actually started off studying self-control. She did a famous study that actually pushed me and a lot of other people into thinking about these non-cognitive skills. It was a very simple study. She took a bunch of middle school students, and at the beginning of their seventh grade year, she gave them one IQ test and one basic psychological test of your ability to exercise self-control. And what she found was that when she looked at their GPA at the end of that year, their self-control score was a better predictor of their GPA than their IQ, which really challenges a lot of what we think is going on in education. So for a few years, she was kind of the guru of self-control at Penn. But after a few years, she started to feel like self-control wasn't really enough, that there was something about self-control that's it's certainly important, conscientiousness and self-control in terms of what it predicts about your future life. But it's really about just following the rules and controlling your impulses, delaying gratification, it's kind of about being square. And it's not really the kind of character strength that leads to starting a rock band or founding a software company or doing anything all that exciting. And so she decided to come up to try to figure out what this quality was that helped people succeed in that bigger way, and she came up with grit. And grit still has a lot of self-discipline in it, but it also involves passion. The term she uses is persistence in pursuit of a passion. So it's kids who are very focused on a goal. They have a dream that they really want to accomplish, and they're able to avoid all obstacles, to avoid distraction, to focus on where they're going.
Paul Tough, the author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Tough spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 20th, 2012. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
8:22, more from Paul Tough in a moment, 94.9, KUOW. A Pakistani teenager and her father, who are advocates for girls' education, tell how the Taliban has threatened to kill them. Also, one of the most politically polarizing figures in Pakistan is visiting Canada. Shell Canada has been assessing the impact of its oil sands project and predicts massive habitat destruction in Alberta. And an autograph collector talks about selling off pieces of his 30-year collection to raise funds for his sick daughter. All these points tonight at 11. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows around 40. Mostly cloudy. Chance of rain after midnight. Friday highs near 50. Rain at times. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows somewhere in the 40s. Cloudy. Chance of rain. Saturday, a bit milder. Highs lower to mid-50s. Rain at times.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Paul Tough uses research in neuroscience, economics, and psychology to advocate a new way of thinking about children's success. Tough is the author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Tough spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 20th, 2012. Next, he talks about how certain schools measure character strength, which leads to a character report card.
So at KIPP, this list of 7 character strengths has become a character report card. 4 times a year, if you're a student at KIPP Infinity, you are evaluated by each of your teachers in each of these 7 character strengths. To understand the idea behind the character report card, I think it's useful to know about the research of a Stanford psychologist named Carol Dweck, which has to do with this concept she came up with called mindset. So Carol Dweck found that one of the most important predictors of a child's success is what they think, their opinion on this one specific question, the question of the malleability of intelligence. So I want to ask you for a little audience participation, a show of hands. So she divides the world into people who have a fixed mindset and people who have a growth mindset. So the question is, if you believe that IQ is essentially fixed, that after a certain age you can't really change your IQ very much, please raise your hand. A few brave souls. And if you believe that we can essentially change our IQ, improve it, or even take away IQ points, please raise your hand. Aha, you all have the growth mindset. So the first was the fixed mindset, the second was the growth mindset. The strange thing about this study is that actually when you look at the data, it's actually very difficult to change your IQ. IQ does not change very much. The people who have the fixed mindset are probably right on the merits. But the people who have the growth mindset, misguided though they may be, actually do better in life, especially for kids. When kids believe that they can improve their intelligence, even if they can't, they improve lots of other things. It gives them the message that they can grow, improve, change, and so they work harder, they try more, they believe that they can do a lot more. The growth mindset is especially effective for people who are under what psychologists call stereotype threat. People who believe because of their group identity that they're more prone to failure. We especially see stereotype threat with African Americans in educational and academic settings, where they often get anxious, according to the theory, that they're going to be judged as not being intellectually able. And so if you remind a black student that they're black right before they take a test, they actually do worse. The same thing happens with girls and math. When girls are reminded that they're girls right before they take a math test, they do worse because of stereotype threat. And there was this study that was done with growth mindset, where even one of the principles behind the growth mindset is that even if we can't change intelligence, people can change their mindset. Some psychologists working with Carol Dweck did this experiment where they took middle school students and they paired them with a college mentor. And the college mentors just gave them some sort of motivational talks, and they divided them into a control group and a treatment group. The control group just heard a basic sort of motivational anti-drug message, and the treatment group heard a growth mindset message. They heard this idea that, you know, we can improve our intelligence, scientists know this now, and you should just think about this as you go through your school year. And the kids who heard the growth mindset message did better at the end of the year on their statewide standardized tests than the kids who didn't. And the kids who improved the most were the ones who were under that stereotype threat, especially the girls. So on this Texas statewide standardized test, girls usually score 10 points behind boys on the math part of the test. And the ones who heard the growth mindset message closed that gap completely. They went from 74 to 84. So what the character report card at KIPP does is it takes that concept of the growth mindset and it transfers it from intelligence to character. It gives kids the message, your character can change, and you can change it. In some ways, I think the phrase, the character report card, is a misnomer. I think a better way to define it would be as a character conversation piece. I went to the first report card night where they were giving out these character report cards, and what happened was really interesting. At sets of desks, a parent, a teacher, and a student would sit down together and they would talk about the student's character. They would talk about how your teachers think you're particularly strong in optimism and that you could use some more help with self-control, and we think you can improve, and here are some things you might try to improve those skills. And I realized that, you know, this is not a conversation that happens very often in educational settings. Anytime those three people are sitting together and talking about behavior in any way, it's usually because the child has just tried to burn down the school, and the whole conversation is done in the language of failure and disappointment and punishment and blame. But none of that was true in this conversation. It was all done in the context of growth. We think you can change, you can make yourself better in these profound and important ways. So KIPP and Riverdale partnered to create the list of character strengths. But KIPP is doing the character report card, and Riverdale is not. And when I asked Dominic Randolph, the head of school at Riverdale, why he's not doing a character report card, he said that for his population, which is sort of a classic New York City, intense, private school, competitive, high-achieving population, if he started giving out report cards for things like curiosity and zest, there would be $400-an-hour curiosity tutors roaming the halls of Riverdale. And Kaplan would be offering zest test prep classes that everyone at Riverdale would go to. And in fact, that was the opposite of what he wanted for his students. I found Dominic really interesting because, again, on paper, his kids were doing great. But he felt like they were missing out on some important opportunities. He felt like they were protected from challenge, protected from adversity by their parents, by their school, and by their whole culture. And as a result, they were missing out on the kind of risks, the kind of challenges that really create character. When you talk about kids at a school like Riverdale not being challenged, I think people kind of get upset, because the lives of private school kids these days are actually very difficult. They're under a ton of stress. They're working really hard. They're often totally burned out. They have a ton of homework. But I think that Dominic is right, that often they are not really challenged. In some ways, it's like the difference between exercising on a treadmill and climbing a mountain. You know, if you exercise on a treadmill, it's really, really hard. It's exhausting. It's completely debilitating. I can barely do it. But you actually kind of know that you're going to get through your half hour that you've punched into the computer. Whereas if you're climbing a mountain, you might get the same cardiovascular workout, but you also have a different kind of challenge. You're doing something you don't know if you can do. You're taking some real risks. You might actually fail. And it was this idea of failure that was central to Dominic Randolph's thinking. He said that character strengths like grit and self-control really come out of failure. And in most high-achieving academic environments in the United States these days, no one really fails anything. And so schools like that produce students who go out into the world with great test-taking abilities, but not much ability to make their way into the world. And they often feel entirely lost. I wrote an article about this character experiment at Kip and Riverdale in the New York Times Magazine a year ago. And I heard back from a lot of readers and emails and comments they posted on the New York Times website. And a lot of them were from adults who felt like this was the experience that they had had as kids. There was one, a man named Dave, who wrote, "I'm left now in my 30s, often wondering how much more I could have accomplished if I wasn't terrified of failure and prone to shying away from ventures where my success wasn't guaranteed." I read this blog post that I found particularly relevant to this idea by a man named James Kwok. He's a Harvard grad who went on to become a McKinsey consultant, now a law professor. And the title of his post was, "Why Do Harvard Kids Head to Wall Street?" So I thought I knew the answer to this. I thought the answer was money. And that's certainly part of it. And it is amazing when you look at some of these Ivy League schools, Princeton especially. So Princeton in 2010, 50% of the graduates either went into management consulting or investment banking. And you got to remember, in 2010, this was after the most gigantic collapse of the financial sector that we've ever had, or at least had in the last 70 years in this country. A few years ago, it was more like 75% of graduates who were going into those two professions. So James Kwok was trying to figure out, or trying to explain why this was, and he talked about his own experience becoming a McKinsey consultant. And he said it wasn't the money, it was that becoming a consultant was part of that same treadmill that he had been on all through high school and all through college. It was familiar. And that actually, especially the recruiters for these firms, are really good at understanding that treadmill psychology. And they make the recruitment process and the selection process very familiar, exactly like the kind of competition that these kids went through to get into the best high schools, to get into the best colleges. And so even though, again, they're working very hard, they're not challenged. As he put it, Harvard undergraduates are driven more by the fear of not being a success than by a concrete desire to do anything in particular. So the headline that the New York Times Magazine put on this article that I wrote was, "What if the secret to success is failure?" So I think that was a good attention-getting headline. But I also think it's not quite that simple. I don't think that failure itself leads to success. I did a lot of reporting for this book in high-poverty neighborhoods, especially on the south side of Chicago. And in those neighborhoods, there is no absence of failure. The problem isn't a lack of adversity. In fact, kids there face all kinds of failure. They're surrounded by adversity. And it doesn't, for the most part, make them stronger and more resilient. For the most part, it really wears them down. I think what we have in this country is an adversity gap, where there are some kids who are growing up, especially in disadvantaged homes and neighborhoods, who just have too much adversity in their lives. And what they really need from us more than anything else is some protection from that adversity. And then we have other kids who are, especially those who are growing up in affluent homes, who don't have enough adversity in their lives. So that idea, I think, for me as a parent is particularly challenging, because I feel like there's something deep in my DNA that wants to protect my son from all adversity all the time. But I think there's something to this idea that in trying to protect him from adversity, I'm actually potentially doing him harm. There was this study that came out a little while ago from the State University of New York at Buffalo, where they tried to measure the effect of adversity on people's on people's lives. So they gave 2,000 adults these two questionnaires. One was an adversity checklist. It was a list of adverse experiences that you might have experienced in your life. Not like terrible traumas, but things like the divorce of your parents, losing a job, living through a natural disaster. And then they gave a standard set of psychological tests, just measures of mental well-being and happiness. And for the most part, they found what you'd expect. The more trauma you'd experienced in your life, the more adverse experiences, the less happy you were. For people who had experienced 12 or 13 or 15 of these adverse experiences, they had the lowest scores on the happiness scale and on the mental health scales. And then they noticed something curious, which was that there were 200 of their respondents who hadn't checked off a single box on the adversity questionnaire. They hadn't experienced any adversity in their lives at all. So they looked at the slope of the graph and they said, wow, these must be the happiest, best-adjusted people in the entire country. But of course, when they looked at their scores, they were not. They were actually no happier than the people who had had 10 adverse experiences. And the people who were the happiest and best adjusted were the ones who had had 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 of these adverse experiences. So why is some adversity a good thing, a moderate amount of adversity? I think it's because it gives us some practice in dealing with failure. It gives us a way to learn how to manage failure. And that idea, the importance of learning how to manage failure, is a theme that runs through a lot of the chapters in this book. I think it's what those rat mothers were doing when they were licking and grooming their kids, giving them a way to deal with this stress, to calm themselves down. I think it's what those KIPP teachers were doing when they were helping these kids deal with their character situations. But the place where I saw it most vividly was over a chessboard. So I don't know if any of you are chess people. I wasn't a chess kid growing up, but there's a whole chapter in my book about scholastic chess. And so I spent a lot of time hanging out at chess tournaments over the past few years. And if you do that, you discover that there is an achievement gap in chess that is similar to the achievement gap in our schools. That the kids who win most trophies at chess tournaments, the schools that take home the tournament prizes, tend to be private schools or well-off suburban public schools or magnet schools or selective exam schools in some form. Or at least that has been true until the last few years in the middle school years in the United States. And now that equation has been thrown off completely by one school, Intermediate School 318, which is a regular public school in Brooklyn that serves mostly low-income kids. And for the past 5 years, they have won every middle school trophy, every championship, at every tournament they've gone to. They made it onto the front page of the New York Times this past spring for winning the National High School Championship, which is really a remarkable achievement when you realize that none of them are yet in high school. And yet they beat some of the best high school players from across the country. So a few years ago when I was starting the reporting on this book, they were just starting their winning streak, and I wanted to try to figure out why. Why were they so good? At first I suspected there was some trick, that somehow they were selecting all the smartest kids from across New York City, that there was some secret exam to get into this school. But there wasn't. It really is just a regular public school. And in fact, the kids who do best on the chess team aren't necessarily the quote-unquote smartest, at least not according to their achievement test scores. I think that what's going on is that the teacher, Elizabeth Spiegel, is able to give these kids the character strengths that they need to succeed. And the way that she does that is through her very unusual teaching strategy. And I think what she's really doing is giving them a way to manage failure. One thing I didn't realize about chess until I started hanging out at these tournaments is that in chess, you fail all the time. You're just surrounded by failure. No matter how good you are, you lose about half your games. And even when you win, you're making dozens of boneheaded mistakes every game. So when you're a middle school kid and you're surrounded by failure like that, there's two temptations. One is to just kind of laugh it off, to say, chess is a stupid game anyway, I didn't really care about it, it's dumb. And the other is to sort of wallow in the shame of your loss And to convince yourself you're the worst chess player ever and really the worst person ever. And there are plenty of kids on the IS318 team who do both of these things. And Elizabeth Spiegel's job is to guide them through these two temptations. And the way she does it is by making them face up really honestly and straightforwardly with their own mistakes, with their own failings. There's this tradition at tournaments, if you're on the IS318 team, after every game you have to sit down with Ms. Spiegel and replay your game move by move. And I sat in on a lot of these sessions, and they are grueling. And the reason that they're grueling is that Ms. Spiegel is kind of tough. I sort of expected that as they were playing through, she would be saying things like, oh, you know, it's just a game, you know, did you have fun? That's what's important. But she doesn't do anything like that. She's saying things like, a rook? Why would you move a rook? It's a terrible move. What were you thinking? Did you pay any attention to the board at all? But somehow it works. The kids really respond. And then she tells them what they could have done differently. And they go out the next game, and it actually works. There's this rule of thumb that teachers have that I hadn't known about, but the more teachers I talk to, the more seem to know about this rule, which is that you're supposed to give 5 compliments for every 1 criticism. That if you fall below that ratio, you're going to wound your students' self-esteem. And Elizabeth told me about this because she was actually worried. She said, you know, I think maybe my numbers are slipping a little bit. And I said, yeah, they're definitely slipping. For her, it was more like 5 criticisms for every compliment. But somehow it worked. And I think a lot of us have had that experience, whether it's with a chess coach or an athletic coach or a music teacher, someone who's in that training relationship with kids, where you know that they are paying close attention to what you're doing, even if they're not being all that nice to you, even if they're being a little hard on you, pushing you a little bit, telling you that you can succeed more than you maybe believe that you can. I think what they're doing is they're giving you a way of managing failure, of managing adversity. And in the process, they're helping you develop character. I think figuring out exactly how to do this is one of the great conundrums of teaching, and I think it's one of the great conundrums of being a parent as well. So when Ellington was born, I was like a lot of anxious parents, really caught up in the cognitive hypothesis. I believed that if I didn't break out the Mozart CDs and the Baby Einstein DVDs in the maternity ward, he would never get into the college of his choice. But reading all of this research had the surprising effect of making me calm down a little bit as a parent. I mean, I certainly believe from this research that the first few years of life are very important. But I think that the things that he is learning and has learned in those first few years are not things that can be taught on flashcards. Some of the research that had the biggest effect on me was the research around attachment. This idea that having the right kind of bond, a secure attachment between a parent and a child, has a tremendously transformative effect on that child. It doesn't have to be some kind of super elite attachment. Just regular, plain, good old parenting makes a huge difference in a child's prospects. And what matters, I think, for those first few years is being as loving as possible, being as attentive and as attuned as possible, coming every time they cry. But one of the complicating things about parenting is that when you have a 5-year-old or a 15-year-old or a 25-year-old, say, living in your basement, it's actually not a good idea to come every time they cry. And in fact, it can be quite damaging. So I think I'm at this transition phase right now with a 3-year-old. I'm trying now to hold back a little bit, to not be quite so attentive, to not help him with every problem, to let him do things on his own. And in fact, I think like every 3-year-old before him, that's exactly what he wants. He wants to prove himself. He wants to prove his independence. This is a lot more difficult for me and for his mother than the licking and grooming and hugging and playing. It's hard to pull back. It's hard to let him suffer. It's hard to let him experience adversity. But I know that that's exactly what he needs. I need to let him fall and pick himself back up. I really believe what Dominic Randolph says, that In the end, if I want him to succeed, I first have to let him fail. So I'm going to end there, and I'd gladly take your questions. Thank you.
Paul Tough, the author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Tough spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 20th, 2012. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
8:46, more from Paul Tough in a moment, 94.9 KUOW. Republicans are pushing efforts to crack down on voter fraud, but others say the problem is extremely rare. A conversation about the scope of voter fraud and what's being done to prevent it tonight at midnight. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight: lows around 40, mostly cloudy, chance of rain after midnight. Friday highs near 50, rain at times. Doug Fullington, founder and artistic director of the Seattle-based Tudor Choir, talks about the history and repertoire of his ensemble, which begins its 20th anniversary season this Saturday. Also, Seattle Magazine editor-at-large Knut Berger talks about the increasing political diversity of people who live on the east side of Lake Washington, which is the subject of his most recent column at crosscut.com. And the University of Southern California Rossier School of Education is the number one ranked school of education in the country and has created the very first online Masters in Teaching program. The school's dean tells how they do it. All these items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock hour. I'm sorry, right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Paul Tough is the author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Tough discusses how character, and not IQ, is the biggest factor in predicting early success. He spoke at Town Hall on September 20th, 2012. Next, he takes questions from the audience.
My name is Luke McQuaid. I work up in Edmonds as a social worker, behavior specialist at the Edmonds School District, and I'm a dad. Do you anticipate or are you aware of any plans to kind of do some expansion in terms of the system at the one school you mentioned where they do character report cards conferences, where maybe that might grow in the future to include a discussion within that triad, if you will, about the teacher's character, about the parent's character, and even if we were to extend that, and so anticipation or knowledge of plans to even extend that further than that really meaningful triad to employers, to CEOs, to politicians. You know, because if this is something rich and we believe in it at this level, wouldn't it be important as a community, not just one part?
Yeah, I think it would. Something I certainly find from doing this reporting and something I think they've found at these schools is that, yeah, these character strengths are not just for kids. The teachers at KIPP actually gave themselves the report card and took some of these same, took the grit test and some other tests to try to measure their own character strengths. And I think, you know, I certainly find as I think about my own life and think about, you know, being a writer and being a parent as I did all this reporting, I think constantly about my own character strengths. So I feel like it's a really useful frame for anyone to succeed. One interesting thing is that actually it's business that tends to use these sorts of measures more than anyone else. Like conscientiousness as a psychological category, which we now know is this really strong predictor of all kinds of success, it wasn't being studied in academia in the 1970s and 1980s because it was seen as too kind of square. And the people who were studying it, who really pushed the field forward, were the industrial organizational psychologists, the human resource guys, who found like conscientiousness really pays off in the workplace. We want to find out how to measure it so we can hire more conscientious people. So I think that business, in lots of ways, is engaged in this question simply because they want to make more money. But I think sometimes they can be positive in this realm. Yes?
I've studied your work and other work concerning the Kipp schools, the Harlem Children's Zone, and what I'm finding out, I've just become a teacher, much because of the fact I have a 5-year-old daughter here and a 10-year-old son, and I've experienced the same type of feeling as a father that you have, concerned with my children's education and them having a chance to achieve what they want to achieve in their life, but also be happy. What have you found in your studies that helps a parent or a teacher, generally within a period of, say, one school year, which is normally a critical measurement in terms of where a child is? Generally, by the time they're third grade on up, they're getting standardized tests. But beyond that, that helps them to grow. And for a teacher that is working with a group of kids that have been facing failure and adversity for years, that allows them to turn that around, to believe in themselves, and to really start to see that they have a chance to succeed.
That's a great question, and I wish I had a more clear answer on how teachers can help kids in that situation. So in the book, I talk about a number of teachers who I think are doing a good job at making that happen, and I think there are lots of examples out there of teachers and schools and school systems that are able to create environments where kids can really improve rapidly. But I don't think we know the answer on a large scale. I mean, certainly a lot of this character work, a lot of these interventions in terms of non-cognitive skills are still pretty experimental. In lots of ways, it's a new idea in terms of trying to introduce it into a curriculum. So, you know, I actually think that's an okay place for us to be right now. I feel like the educational innovations that I think have made the most impact have started from the ground up rather than, you know, curriculums that are imposed on a whole school system. So I wish it could speed up as well. I wish there was a set of tools that any teacher could use. But I think what there are is a set of principles and ideas that different teachers and different parents are interpreting and implementing in their own way. Thank you. I think we probably have time for 3 more questions. Okay. Yes?
My name is Jessica Holloway, and I'm an elementary art teacher in the Bellevue School District, so I teach K-5. And I was very excited to see your list and to hear you on This American Life this weekend. And
okay.
I thought, these are all things that arts teachers are trying to teach to all of the time. If nothing else in my career that I'm teaching kids, I'm teaching this these chances to take risks, these chances to be, to persevere, to be resourceful. And so I wanted to know what kind of evidence that you had seen in your research about arts education and its benefits towards kids and helping them in that way.
So it's a great question. And so all I know is anecdotally that I certainly hear from lots of teachers and lots of students that arts education makes a huge difference, especially when it comes to curiosity, which is a character strength that I didn't talk as much as I did about grit, but that I think is really critical, and that I think a lot of educational systems, schools that we have right now, tend to thwart curiosity and creativity more than they help guide it. So that's where I think arts education can really come in. Thanks. Yes.
Hello, my name is Pat Cummings, and I work in day job in educational research. I was really struck by your last chapter when I read the book in light of the Chicago teacher strike, which I understand the primary reason for the strike was the tying academic test scores to value-added teacher evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the foundation of No Child Left Behind and even Race to the Top. It's the metric by which we measure the success and value of our teachers and the success of our school is this cognitive academic feature having nothing to do with all of the other myriad factors related to character education. And I'd just like to have your thoughts about that, about specifically how this value added has taken over, in my opinion, prominently taken over how we're measuring effectiveness of teaching.
Sure. So, you know, I'm sympathetic to the goals of accountability and even to value added. I mean, I think it's true that there are lots of not great teachers out there teaching kids, and that they tend to be in the schools where low-income kids are, and that, you know, we need to find ways to get a better teaching force and to help teachers get better. But that said, I do feel like the mechanisms that we have in place don't work well enough. And my sense of the research around value-added and around teacher effectiveness is that we don't know enough about it. We don't know enough about how to measure teacher quality and how to improve teacher quality to have the kind of focus on data that we have right now. So, you know, I think it's worth continuing to try to figure out how best to do that. It would be great to really have a system in place that would help teachers get better and help us select teachers better. My worry about it is that it has just served, I think, as a huge distraction in terms of the national conversation about education. That it has, I think, on both sides of the debate, it has just become the main issue. And as you said, I think it was a big part of the Chicago school strike. And really, I think it's a pretty minor one. I mean, it's certainly, I think if you're a teacher, it's a major one. It makes sense that you would care deeply about how you're being evaluated. But I think, you know, for the rest of us who are concerned just about kids doing better, it really does feel mostly like a distraction. That if the real question is how we help lots of kids do better, and especially lots of disadvantaged kids, there are lots of other things we should be talking about, and including this question of which skills we're really trying to teach and how we teach them. So I'm going to take one more question, and then I'm going to be happy to sign books over there. Yes?
Hi. I'm a high school teacher at Taff Academy, which serves minority and low-income populations, and I teach 11th and 12th graders. So my question is, what are the prospects for older students or even adults in terms of changing their character? Because you talked mostly about infants and middle school students.
So, So when I started this reporting, I you know, the research around early childhood is very powerful. It's certainly a great time to intervene, probably the best time to intervene in terms of if you want to make the most impact. But one of the things that surprised me in my reporting is how much time I ended up spending in high schools. And that is because I think there is some pretty persuasive research that adolescence is a second window of opportunity if you want to work on kids' non-cognitive skills and their character strengths. One thing we found is that IQ doesn't change much after about age 8, but neuroscientists can tell us that these non-cognitive skills, what goes on in the prefrontal cortex, is actually malleable far, far later in life into adolescence and even early adulthood. So I think that's part of why adolescent interventions work. There's this phrase, this word that some psychologists use, metacognition, so thinking about thinking. And one of the reasons that they say that adolescence is a good time to intervene with this stuff is that the teenage years are when kids become metacognitive. It's when they can, you know, reflect on themselves and start thinking deeply about themselves. And as you know, if you've raised teenagers, they really love thinking deeply about themselves. And I think that teachers and schools can actually take advantage of that and use that. That's certainly, I think, what they're doing at KIPP and in some of these other interventions. They're using that curiosity that kids have about themselves to teach them strategies. Here are your patterns. Here's what you've been doing. Here's how you react in certain situations. What could you do differently? So I'm going to stop there. And thank you all so much for coming.
Paul Tough, the author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Tough spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 20th, 2012. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from TherapySearch.net, a place to turn when making the important decision of choosing a counselor, providing information to help those seeking counseling make educated choices and find psychotherapists who meet their needs. On the web at TherapySearch.net, 9 o'clock, 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQ.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.